and welcome back to Hey Look Listen. My name is Liam Sheehan and I'm joined here by Jonathan Morrissey and Kevin O'Carroll. Pals, how are you doing today?
Good, Liam. Good. How are you doing?
Grand. I'm all fired up to be talking about my favorite video game franchise.
Oh, we're just going to skip past how I'm doing?
That's... You didn't say anything, so I kept moving.
Well, I was waiting for a lull, but there wasn't. You should have lulled after Kev. And then Wade, you know, I'm okay. I'm all right. But go on.
I've been doing this podcast. Kev for a couple of years, Morrissey for even longer. And it's just really starting to strain on me now. That's the relationship is just starting to, I don't want to use a dramatic metaphor, but... Burn,
yeah, fall apart, yeah. In front of our listeners, yeah,
for context for the listeners, we've been trying to record this intro for a while now, and the energy is weird. So strap in, I guess.
Oh, long story short, we are talking about The Legend of Zelda this week. The two Switch versions of it, the two latest ones. But before we get onto that, I'm very interested in what you're playing because I did the last episode. By myself, I think, was the one before that. Your one, Kev?
Or I think so, yeah. I think we've had two solo episodes on the balance now, so...
Regardless, it's been a long time since the three of us have chatted, so I really don't know what you're playing. So, Kev, I'll start with you. What are you playing at the moment?
Yeah, so I am in the middle of yet another move, and I do not currently own a television. Mm-hmm. So I am playing things mostly like streaming xCloud on the laptop or remote play from the PS5. So I got Final Fantasy VII Rebirth on release and have tried playing it. And I'm kind of hating the experience in a way that's not the game's fault, but is actually kind of souring me on the game. So I've made the decision to just stop playing it for a while until I have a setup that'll allow me to do it. Because... I've heard people like complaining about the motion blur in it, but if you think that's blurry, like try playing it on remote play with about 5 megs of Wi-Fi. It is honestly, it's like watching a PowerPoint presentation through a window that's smeared in Vaseline. It is incredibly frustrating. So whatever sort of goodwill I'm able to muster towards the open world stuff that I might find a bit tedious anyway is being completely wiped away by the technology. So I'm about an hour and a half, 2 hours into it. Like on an objective level, I can see that it's great, but on a subjective level, I was kind of hating it. So I had to stop. Hopefully I'll loop back around to it as soon as possible. I know, or at least I think you're playing it at the moment, Liam. Is that right?
I am. Thoughts? I am. Well, how long did you say you were into it? Two?
Maybe 2 hours. I think I'm in the second chapter, Chocobo Bill, that kind of area.
I think I hit 42 there.
Okay.
No way.
Oh my God. Like I hate to hear that you're having a bad time with it because sometimes I think I'm dreaming playing it. Okay. Honestly, I'm like, is this game real? Did they do this? It is absolutely incredible. I am loving it. Wow. I am absolutely loving it and kind of stand outside of it for a second. Like, I think it's one of the best JRPGs in the last decade easily. For Final Fantasy VII fans, I think it's absolutely essential. It's just this wonderful, like not even a love letter, just expansion of the original thing. And for someone who just like loves Final Fantasy VII as much as I do, I'm just like, oh yeah, like I said, I'm pinching myself. To talk about the open worlds and stuff, though, Kev, that is what you have to know going into it, is that it's open worlds very much takes its cues from your Horizon Zero Dawns and your kind of...
So the Ubisoft formula. Like
Ubisoft is what I was going to say, yeah.
Towers
and kind of the towers put kind of markers on your map. Now the game does kind of fan open and close, kind of, so you hit an open world section and you can breeze through if you want. There's absolutely nothing stopping you from breezing through it, or you can kind of spend time, and then it kind of closes around a kind of story driven bit for a long time. But
okay,
it's absolutely like gorgeous. Like the open world vistas are amazing. But what really, like, there's 17,000 things I can talk about with this game. Like, there's literally no time. But
take your time.
But it's it's one of the most, just in terms of its towns and its like smaller locations, it's one of the most like textured worlds I've ever. If games are these transportive things that like put us into these worlds, like this is one of the best ones I've ever been in. Adding to that it's recreating these places like from my youth that are super important to me.
Yeah.
And then I like, you know, all the other stuff is just, the combat system is one of the, an all-timer, is one of the best. So, yeah, so the kind of the open world side quests and stuff can be a little bit, you know, grindy, but it's all built around an amazing combat system. It's like, I'm not going to say the side quests are all like amazing. Some of them are, I would say, get to kind of bad, but they're all kind of built around like character relationships. Even if you're just like, someone's like, oh, I've lost some chickens, can you go get them for me? It always kind of links one of your other characters.
Yeah. I've heard
that. Yeah, to Cloud for that side quest. So this would be a Cloud and Tifa side quest, and they'll kind of bond over and stuff like that, you know?
You're not the first person who's mentioned that chicken side quest to me. I have no idea what it's about, but anyone who's brought it up has been like, yo, have you played the chicken quest yet? So I'm like, okay, I got to at least see the chickens, you know?
Gameplay-wise, it's an absolute nightmare. That's why it jumped into my head. I shouldn't be talking about it. There's so many things to love about this game. And all the other stuff, the stuff that remake did well, the characters... I love these versions of the characters. Like, I'm not going to spoil anything. Obviously, I haven't been online to see anything yet on how people are feeling about this game. They made one decision with one of the main characters that I'm sure is going to be divisive, but I'm really excited to see what people think about it, because I'm just like, this is great. This is just a great idea, great expansion of this character. This world. Oh my god, I'm absolutely loving it. I'm glad we're doing this today, because I'm like playing too much of it, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like, any free time I have is like that game at the moment. I haven't been as obsessed with a game like this in a long time. But there's at least 50,000 side are mini games in it.
Yep.
At least four of them I can think of in my head now are games within the game that probably could be released like as a mobile game, you know?
Yeah, that Queen's Blood card game thing.
Yeah, that'd be one of them, yeah.
That did me a huge solid favor. Because it is kind of similar to how the Marvel Snap game plays. It's the same idea of like playing cards into three separate lanes. And it was good enough that it broke my Marvel Snap addiction and I was finally able to uninstall the game. So if I never touch Final Fantasy VII Rebirth again, it's already done me one solid.
Look, I can see myself talking about this game a lot on the podcast because like, there's something going on. I think this is one of the special ones, honestly. But what I will say is this game is massive. And... yes, in the sense that there's big open worlds to explore in it. It's a big open world areas and environments. But it's just massive in terms of, you know, I have this kind of weird feeling that's hard to kind of put into words, where back in the PS1 days, you used to play these JRPGs, and yeah, they were little polygon little characters running around, but
yeah,
they had these pre-rendered backgrounds, you know, the world kind of came alive through that, and they were huge adventures. You go to many different places, you know? And I feel like the graphics continue to get better. You think games would get bigger, but I always felt like the JRPG kind of lost something because they had to render these worlds with these amazing graphics that you kind of, there was always kind of concessions that had to be made and the experience kind of had to be pared down. Like the way Final Fantasy 13 was just a long big corridor. Final Fantasy 16 is super empty and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, even 10 is essentially a corridor.
Yeah. This is like a modern game with like modern graphics and like modern, like there's been no concessions made. It's this massive thing. And everything that was present in the original Final Fantasy VII is here. They haven't skipped anything, and it's expanded on. And you like, if there's a town you pass through in 5 minutes in the original Final Fantasy VII, that's probably part of your childhood. You're going to spend 2 hours in there. There'll be a bit to wander around a town and hang out with all your characters and see what they're doing in the town. It's just this, it's this game that allows yourself to breathe, and I'm just absolutely loving it. Really, really loving it. I have problems with it, but they might be for later on. Right now, they're being like cemented over by everything I love about it. I couldn't be enjoying a video game more.
Yeah, I feel like we're probably going to get an episode out of that one. Although given our recent timelines, it'll be in about
we just hit time. We're done.
But yeah, I'm like, look, Kev, I'll say to you, because you know the original, where I am now is I'm in Cosmo Canyon.
Okay, cool.
So knowing what I know, but how much the game covers plot wise. Like I might only be halfway through this game.
I think you are.
It's absolutely gargantuan, but yeah, that's enough for now. Marcy, what are you playing at the moment?
Yeah, that as well. So I guess you've just kind of stolen my thunder. No. One question I have for you, Adeline, before we go into mine, is it like, it sounds like a huge step up from the previous like remake, from the kind of first installment. Would you say that?
Yeah, definitely. Now
I was expecting more of the same. I don't know why. I wasn't expecting, you know, a huge improvement like in that regard.
The biggest compliment I'll give them is that even though they had the engine and they had all the framework made in that first game, I think this is pretty spectacular that Square got this out in 4 years. It's a very content rich game. Like, and they didn't rest on their laurels. I'm telling you, expect Chocobo Racing to come out as its own game, because this is a Mario Kart game within the game. Like, even the mini games, they just put all this effort into it. You know, it's crazy, absolutely crazy.
God, me. Oh, I look forward to it. I suppose for me, I haven't since the Wii episode, since I've been on the podcast. I played a lot. Went back and revisited Metal Gear Solid. Played through that remake there on the Master Collection. The collection is fine. Like, it doesn't add much to the game, but the game is still perfect.
Yeah.
In my nostalgia kind of viewed eyes. But what I've been kind of what I kind of jumped into after that was Yakuza Zero. A few videos and a few photos and things like that, and I've been kind of playing on the Steam Deck, and it's just completely batshit insane, right? Yeah. 1 minute, I'm in the middle of the most intense 30-minute cutscene, with people cutting off their fingers because they're trying to leave the Yakuza, to the next scene, and I'm trying to explain this as best I can. Coming across a young girl who's in a queue to buy a video game. And then a man comes along and steals the game off of her. You chase after the man. Mm-hmm. When you get to the man, someone comes along and steals the game off of that man. Then you go off again, chase that other guy. You find him. Someone is stealing the game off of him. And then that happens one more time. And when you finally confront that final guy and say, hey, Jesus, I've been looking, searching and chasing you for like a half hour. The girl comes back and is like, oh my God, dad.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, this is the most insane. Yeah. I've done really nothing. I've just had a couple of kind of skirmishes and just kind of mad cutscenes. But I am loving it. I don't see how you couldn't. But what I want to talk about just quickly is what I'm trying to do for this month and next month, while kind of tipping away in Yakuza, is actually try and play through as many short games as I can.
Oh, cool.
Because I don't know if you guys felt that about last year, but last year there was just... every game felt like it was massive. We'll probably get to that now in a minute. But so I've kind of picked out a whole bunch of shorter games to play through. Some I've played already, like Papers, Please. But I want to kind of go back and finish that. Abzu, have you guys ever played that?
No, it's been on my radar for a while, but I never actually got around to playing it. It looks very pretty.
It is, yeah. It looks fantastic. Yeah, made by the guys who made Journey. Just imagine Journey, but underwater.
Yeah.
Which is a bit unfair to it. But it's incredible. I'm about halfway through that now. Brothers, which I think, Liam, you've talked about on the podcast quite a bit. And then when I finished the day before yesterday, A Short Hike. Which, Kev, have you talked about it on the podcast before, or just in our group chat?
I'm not sure. I've definitely ranted about it before, but I don't know if we were recording or if you were just tolerating my presence. It's a game I absolutely love.
It is. It's just lovely. Yeah. It's such a, I think took maybe 3 hours at most.
Oh yeah.
But like, all it is you play this little bird. I think her name is Claire, perhaps. And you basically are trying to get to the top of this huge mountain to make a phone call, really. But it's just, it has such a lovely host of characters. The gameplay is actually very, very simple, but the way they teach you concepts super quickly is actually really impressive. Because a bunch of different things they teach you in the first 10, 15 minutes, and they make it so easy you kind of pick it up. But I don't get choked up playing video games that often.
Yeah.
I know, Kev, were you... that last little, that little scene when you finish it.
It's just really nice.
It is. So I'm enjoying that. I enjoyed that. And so my life is empty. But if you have any other very short games, throw them my way. Me and Owen actually asked ChatGPT to make us a list of short games.
Okay.
And it got a bit confused and just gave us a list of games with short names. So it wasn't very helpful at all.
I guess that's kind of it has recommended IQ, intelligent cube.
X. Just lots of stuff you'd expect. That's why.
Did it recommend Zach and Wiki Quest for Barbarossa's Treasure?
Fair fucking play for pulling out that bell top of your head there. No, they did not. Genuinely though, if anyone's seen other amazing short games I can play, I'm thinking like less than 5 hours.
Mm. Yeah.
It's kind of that really, really sweet spot. Let me know, because I'm trying to get through as many as I can this year.
It's always good to play more indie games as well. It's good for the soul.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think so, yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of indie games though, let's talk about The Legend of Zelda.
Never heard of it.
Now, we've been threatening to do an episode about Tears of the Kingdom for a while now. It came out summer of last year. It was a pretty big deal to some people. But before we get on to that, let's just talk about its predecessor first. So Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild came out in 2017, which is an amazing thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
Time marches inexorably on, my friends.
That's upsetting, yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely fine.
Very much tied to the excitement that was the Nintendo Switch. And it's so weird to talk about the Nintendo Switch on the podcast now, because I think we all kind of feel that, you know, its time is done. Mm-hmm. Let's move on. What's Nintendo doing next? And But remember when it came out, and half of the excitement about the console for me was that the fact that it was launching with Breath of the Wild. Mm-hmm. Which was like, you know, Zelda's my favorite franchise. I don't mind talking about it anytime, but this was one of the most exciting releases, because it was just something brand new. And now that the dust has settled on it, and it's this, like, you know, we always talk about the podcast, open world games, we're sick of open world games, you know. Yeah. Kev's having kind of a bad time with open world Final Fantasy there, but yeah, do you have any thoughts on Breath of the Wild now, all these years later, you know? Because I still think, you know, anytime we need to talk about open worlds in the podcast, I'm like, Elden Ring, Breath of the Wild, you know, that's how you do it.
Yeah, you know, the two good ones. I think for me, Breath of the Wild is, it's like if Da Vinci had done like a Mona Lisa 2, would we still be impressed by the first one? In that, I think Breath of the Wild is an excellent game that has been...
Full. I didn't mean to laugh at that.
It was a joke, so it's okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Breath of the Wild is an excellent game, but like so much of what it does well is done better in the sequel. And that's not to take away from the first game. If anyone said to me that they preferred the first game, I would understand and respect that, and then quietly think they were wrong.
I totally agree, because my biggest complaint with Breath of the Wild was that sometimes the world felt a bit empty. You know, I felt that, you know, I sometimes was going great distances and not really coming across a whole bunch that was super getting me excited. Mm. I think Tears of the Kingdom then just went, well, shut up then, here's two more maps. Like, once you shut up, here's one in the sky and one underground. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry for ever doubting you at all. But I will say Breath of the Wild probably gave me like that feeling, I think we talked about, Liam, on the Wii episode, of that kind of, you know, you're holding a new piece of technology in your hand that you've been waiting for a while. It's a new game you've been waiting for a while. And that first kind of bit at the start of Breath of the Wild, we kind of, you know, you wake up and you come out and you see Hyrule in front of you. I was like, oh man, I was just so ready for that. I was very, very excited for it. So yeah, but you're bang on, Kev. The sequel did so pretty much everything better.
Do you kind of, in your head, do you kind of link it to the advent of a new console? Is it very much like the Switch, the early butterflies period of the Switch is just playing Breath of the Wild, is it?
Yeah, 100%, because I went mad in it. I spent so much time in the and I just moved to a new place in Canada as well. And so, because remember at the time, the Switch was really hard to get for a long, long time. And so I think I've told a story before, but you know, we don't have any people who actually listen to this really anymore, I think, so it's fine. But I think we basically Steph was like, oh, you know, I know we can get this in Ottawa. I was like, you can't, like the guys are saying it's sold out everywhere. Owen was saying in Toronto, he can't find it. You know, you're going to struggle. We went to basically what she called, it's called Carlton Mall. Okay. And it's a mall for old people.
Okay.
Which it sounds mean, but that's lit. You go there and it's like, oh my God. It's like going back into like the early 80s. It hasn't been updated. A bunch of like people go there to meet older people. Like it's really actually charming and lovely. But she's like, there's a GameStop there. And she says, it's always empty. Like, I don't know how it's still there. It's not anymore. Went in anyway. And I remember literally kind of being like, they're going to laugh at me, Steph. And I was like, hey, have you guys got any Nintendo Switches or maybe even Zelda Breath of the Wild so I can at least pick that up? He opened like the doors and there's hundreds of them. He was like, what colors you want and how many copies of Breath of the Wild? So for me, you're right, Liam. It is that kind of just that real excitement of new technology and then trying it on the TV and then trying a portable and being like, oh my God, I can't believe I can do this. Which, you know, yeah, maybe is that a bit of nostalgia towards it? Oh God, already? Maybe.
I remember it made me realize, you know, because I was, you know, this is something I worry about intermittently. I was like, cold inside adult now. Am I just am I just a husk? But there's few games I can remember being as excited for as I was for Breath of the Wild. It just felt like such a moment. I still, you know, not recently, I'll admit, but over the years since that, I put on the trailer, you know, the launch trailer on YouTube, just because it just reminds me of, because I remember like what I still hold it up as one of the greatest video game trailers ever made.
Yeah,
but it was it kind of began a big change in the Zelda series that we're kind of, you know, it's we're still in, basically, in terms of the mainline 3D console Zelda games. Like I said, I hold it up as a way to do open world games properly. You know, you're kind of not guided by markers on your map, or if you are, they're ones you put yourself. It's kind of all about kind of wanderlust and curiosity. Mm-hmm. We've talked about all that kind of that aspect of it a lot on the podcast, but I like the simplicity of Breath of the Wild. I like the way it's go to these four places if you want, but you know, mm-hmm. you have to go to Hyrule Castle and defeat Ganon. And kind of, and the years and years since the command that spawned so many kind of speedrunners and see how fast they can get to, you know, finish the game. I think it's 10 minutes or something like that at the moment. Mm. I like the simplicity of Breath of the Wild. I like how, like, I think the best Zelda plot lines are the ones that are kind of simple but cool, and then the gameplay kind of holds them up on the sense of place. And I think Breath of the Wild has that. It's like really, it's actually a really melancholic game. You're in a kind of a dead world. You're in a place where, you know, imagine if, you know, a Zelda, and I always think of the 100 years before Breath of the Wild plotline. It's like, imagine if a Zelda game happened, but it went wrong. Yeah. And like everyone lost and Ganon won. And now Link has woken up 100 years later. So I like the way that, you know, the four champions who are at the four different dungeons in the game, they're dead and you're talking to ghosts. And that's kind of permeates the entire game for me. And it's something that Tears of the Kingdom didn't quite have as much for me, is that just that central theming of Breath of the Wild is of that of loss and melancholy, and it's about kind of fighting back against that, I think.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think the two games are a great example of the difference between plot and story. Because the plot of Breath of the Wild is somewhere between nothing and bad. You know, it's like but like the story, the narrative, the as you said, it's about loss and it's about fighting back in a world that's lost everything, and the way that comes across in like the presentation and the world and the vibe is amazing. It's really immersive. It's like, even you mentioned, John, that, you know, that the world feels a little empty, and that's by design, because it's about these terrible hundred years have happened and you're like trying to jumpstart the recovery. So that's all great, but the actual, like, the proper nouns and verbs of the plot are crap. So I think Tears of the Kingdom is almost like a kind of an inversion of that, where I think Tears of the Kingdom has a notably better plot, but the story isn't quite the same because we're familiar with the world already, maybe. Maybe I'm being too harsh there, but that just occurred to me.
I weirdly think you're being too harsh and too nice in equal measures, because, you know.
Okay.
we'll get to Tears of the Kingdom in a moment, but yeah, its story is, it's good. Like, it's
great. It's serviceable. It's fine.
It's grand. But then, but Breath of the Wild, like, it had that simplicity, and then, like, I think I've used the soundbite before. And then the main stories, you know, the stories that you remember from that game, then are the ones that you make.
Yeah,
they're the adventures along the way. That's it. Just getting sidetracked and going to this place and discovering these things. And I don't know if you've ever watched the. There's a big presentation from the Game Developers Conference on the making of Breath of the Wild. Have you ever watched that?
No, I haven't.
The design of it's very, very interesting. It's all about the lead designer describes it's a world built on white lies.
Okay.
Where everything kind of makes sense, but none of it really makes sense. It's all cartoon logic. If they can get you to the idea that, like, wood floats, if I chop down a tree, it'll puff into a log. But if I put that in water, the log will float. If the idea that if you put something metal against electricity, it's kind of all these real world elements, but in kind of cartoon logic, yet it all kind of stands up in itself. And I think that's one of the things that's not really talked about a lot anymore. And we kind of took it for granted in Tears of the Kingdom because it was all set up already, is just the malleability of everything, even in terms of how you can go about anything any way you want in that game just by experimenting with the different kind of systems, you know, just so can I set fire to this thing? Oh, I can, you know, that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, no, and it was like, it's again, it's something that is improved upon in Tears of the Kingdom, but mm-hmm. that's not to overlook that it was revolutionary in Breath of the Wild in the first place, the sort of the physics systems and how they kind of underpin everything in the game. And kind of the player creativity as a result of that. Things like freezing a boulder in time, hitting it to charge it with kinetic energy, and then hanging onto it and using that to sort of shoot yourself across the map. Or like you said, you're like, can I set this on fire? And the answer is usually yes. But then the sort of the next step up from that is like, well, if I set it on fire, then there's going to be updrafts. Can I use those to get to somewhere that I can't normally reach with the amount of stamina I have? And it just lets you play with the systems as they exist and just sort of interact with the world in a way that's kind of like whatever you can think of within the established rules of the game. Yeah, you can probably do it.
It makes the world feel alive. Yeah. And like it's actually things are happening around you. Like a complaint I have, and a complaint we always have about open world games, is that sometimes, like Assassin's Creed is a great example. Yeah. Assassin's Creed looks beautiful. It's amazing. Like NPCs are just going through these kind of, you know, scripted events, the weather changes, etc. But no, I can't really interact with anything. It doesn't really feel like it's happening at random or organically. Yeah. I felt like Breath of the Wild was one of the first games when I was running between, you know, two areas in the map where things that happened felt like natural and organic. And I could just kind of fuck up stuff. I loved that as well. I loved it being this kind of big sandbox. But it's weird. The more we talk about Breath of the Wild already, and I'm trying not to jump ahead, it seems to be so hard to talk about Breath of the Wild now without wanting to then put in a line about Tears of the Kingdom instantly afterwards and saying how it did it better, you know?
But here's the thing. Not only are you absolutely correct there, but I also just feel like Breath of the Wild has been just talked about so much over the years at this point. You know, so
that's fair. Yeah, it has been a long time. Yeah,
so I don't really mind moving on. But what I will say is, when Tears of the Kingdom was coming out, it was actually steeped in a lot of mystery. Like we kind of knew it was a direct follow up to Breath of the Wild, which is not something Zelda often does. You know, same Link, same Zelda. You know, continuing on the story, and we knew some things. But when you finally got your hands on it, like, I'm going to start with a weird kind of potentially negative thing. When you finally got your hands on Tears of the Kingdom, were you disappointed in any way to kind of find out that structurally it was going to be the identical game, in terms of there's four places to go, there's an ultimate goal, there's shrines littered about the map that are, you know, that are mini dungeons and stuff like that, you know? Was like, because we weren't 100% sure that's what it was going to be before we actually booted up the game, you know?
I will, because I'll be quick here, Kev, I'll just say yes. Because and just in the kind of way where it didn't pull me in or suck me in right away. It took me a bit longer to kind of put some proper time into it, but it did feel, and like everyone made this complaint when it first came out. That's why I love the internet and these quick reactions to video games now, because you could see it happening on YouTube, on Reddit, etc. Literally the first 8 hours, people are like, oh, it feels the same. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's just like a reskin. In reality, no, it's not the truth at all, but I will be very honest. The first few hours, I was like, you know, that kind of quiet voice in the back of your head. Not that one, Liam, but you know, that one is kind of like, you know, oh no, is this not going to be as amazing? Like one of the special ones, like you said at the start, Liam, about Final Fantasy. Sadly, I definitely did feel that way in the first few hours.
It's so par for the course for the Zelda franchise, though. Like I would say that the Zelda formula, let's say, like Zelda started with the original, but the Zelda formula was started in the third one, A Link to the Past.
And
then there was the advent of, you know, many things, you know, obviously went full 3D in Ocarina of Time. But arguably they were doing that formula until, you know, the 2010s, you know, until you. So I'm not surprised that kind of Nintendo kind of came up with this new thing for The Legend of Zelda and then kind of, you know, repeated it again. But what they've never done before is reuse a world map.
Yeah.
You're basically in the same world again, which is kind of, you know, at first, when it was announced, people were very kind of, oh, I don't know. But it turned out with the genius of the marketing of Tears of the Kingdom was that they really kept a lot of it behind curtains, more so than you usually see with AAA games anymore, I'd say.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so hard not to bring up what Kev said. I know we've said in like 5 episodes now, the Tears of the Kingdom.
I still can't believe it. I just want to point out that was Owen, not me.
Was that Owen? Owen, I'm so sorry.
Revisionist history again from ours.
We'll edit this out. Yeah, I'm so sorry. That blew my mind though since this day. But yeah, great point.
I think there's two big things to talk about with Tears of the Kingdom, and since you brought up Owen's revelation that the title is a pun, one of the big marketing things was, there's going to be a sky world in this game.
Yeah.
There's going to be, you know, we're going to reuse Hyrule. It's going to be, you know, years later, so there's going to be some differences. You know, the world is rebuilding. And I do like, as a little sidebar, I do like the depiction of time passing that you do see revisiting these old places, you know, and that it is kind of a world rebuilding itself. But But yeah, the kind of main draw was that there was a world up in the sky. But one of my favorite gaming moments I can think of the last few years was diving down into a hole into the depths and thinking I was going to some like mini dungeon or something like that.
Yeah.
And then opening my map and going, wait. Yeah. And I adore that they didn't spoil it. I really do.
Yeah, it's kind of wild to me because it obviously took a lot of development time to make. Like it's not an afterthought. It is a fully functional world map in its own right that's jam-packed full of content, almost all of which is trying to kill you in the most aggressive way.
Yeah.
It really reminds me of, and obviously the games would have been in development around the same time, so I don't think it was an influence, but it really reminds me of Caelid from Elden Ring, the red poison swamp area in Elden Ring, because it is like, it's a bad place to be, and you feel uncomfortable all the time you're there.
And it's dark, and it kind of becomes a different game down there, because you're kind of, yeah, it's mostly combat driven and kind of dungeon crawly, and you're kind of, I like the vibe of it, like you said. I like how hostile it feels. I like how alien it feels. There's some great art design down there with the weird mushrooms and stuff like that, and the music. And like, I think weird enough to say, you know, Zelda always brings new classic music. I think the classic piece of music from Tears of the Kingdom is just the one little flourish of trumpet whenever you dive down into the depths.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that just kind of announces anxiety. It. Yeah,
fear is pure anxiety. But I think, you know, do you really think it was like a very like intentional thing to not reveal it? Because I think it was something they were like keeping in, you know, this kind of ace in the hole kind of thing. You think that was like their intention?
I do. What do you think? It has to be. I do, because it's such a big part of the game. Like even the main story brings you down there a few times, like, you know,
it does. Yeah, especially towards the end of the game, it absolutely does. But I checked earlier today. I think I spent about 115 hours playing it. Mm-hmm. I really went down there.
Really? Yeah.
Really?
And you know, maybe I missed out by doing that. But it was just the pure anxiety it gave me going down there, as opposed to the happiness of land and the even happierness of up in the sky. But yeah, I just think if that is intentional, that's such an incredibly showcase of confidence in the product that they've made, right? That they know they don't need to, people are going to buy it anyway and be excited for it, and then can kind of, you know, kind of find this out afterwards. But the thing I loved the most about the kind of the depths and kind of, you know, really kind of moving around in the sky was how there just seems to be an almost flawless mechanic that they've come up with to navigate both areas. Do you know what I mean? Like, I remember when I first kind of came across the Sky Islands and I was going, this is going to be a pain in the ass to kind of get around. It's going to be difficult. It really wasn't. Gliding everywhere felt amazing. I even found kind of towards the end of the game, being in the depths and kind of, you know, shooting arrows to light your way, you know, kind of not always be able to see where you're going, but kind of trying to figure it out, was just this kind of amazing kind of sense of exploration. It just, to me, it's like every time I came across something new or something different, they had a really good gameplay mechanic figured out about it that worked really well, you know?
There is this kind of, I don't really know the right turn of phrase to describe it, that you don't see in many games where, I think you see this in Zelda in particular, but particularly these two things, and particularly in Tears of the Kingdom, where everything else sprouts out from the mechanic.
Yeah.
So they didn't come up with the idea that you kind of go to the sky first, probably. They came up with the idea that you can you'd have all these different methods to go about the land, you know, and everything sprouted out from that. And just, like, the design is so elegant in Tears of the Kingdom.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the main kind of thing about this game, the thing that's kind of going to be most remembered for, the kind of central concept of it, is the Ultra Hand. So like elevator pitch or elevator opinion, what do you think of the Ultra Hand?
I think it's maybe the most interesting or most exciting video game mechanic I've ever come across in my life.
Yeah, in the history of video
games. When we decided we were covering this topic for today, I thought I better brush up on both games and do a bit of research. And what I did was I just went to the Hyrule Engineering subreddit and I just spent about 2 hours scrolling through posts instead of doing any sort of
videos.
Yeah. It's just incredible. It's just really fascinating how they managed to pull this off. Like, I fundamentally don't understand how they did it. It's amazing.
Kev, give a brief description of what the mechanic is.
You just stick stuff. You stick stuff together and it works.
Yeah, exactly.
You build stuff, don't you?
You build stuff. You stick it together and it works, and somehow it always works.
Someone tried this before, you know, a little company called Rare in a little game called Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts. One of the most hated games of all time, and people have a lot of, you know, in a derisive way sometimes have kind of compared Tears of the Kingdom to it. But I do think it can't really be kind of understated how annoying this mechanic could have been.
Yeah.
And there are moments when I'm like, oh, I gotta go over here and I gotta make a little cart. When I did find it a little bit tedious. Every now and then, you know, like I'd stick a wheel on the wrong way around. I'm like, oh, you fucking put it on properly.
Yeah.
But just the sheer kind of creativity, and also how you, as the hours pass, you know, 10, 20 hours, how you feel yourself, you know, attuning your brain, how this world works, and you just become better at building stuff, and you look at something. And immediately you're like, all right, I'm going to get a rocket and a balloon and a cart, and I'm going to fly across this thing, you know, and it just becomes second nature. And that's not even going to, like, I would say in terms of my creativity in this game, I was very good at kind of, you know, figuring out what would be the best thing to do, you know, for particular circumstances getting across or whatever. But then you go online and the amount of customizability and potential for creativity is astounding. Tanks, mechs. Next, with big swinging cock shooting fire.
I saw one today that maybe not as impressive as giant Robocock, but someone had, and it's just such a simple idea, but it's brilliant. Someone turned some springs upside down and put them between the wheels and the body of a car that they were building, and now the car has suspension, so they can go over bumps and things. It's just
it's literally just incredible.
Just thinking of something, trying it, and it works. It's amazing.
There was people who realized that. You know, you can get those lasers, and you can put them on a moving cart, and then you can put up these, and they make different sounds when the laser hits them, so people are able to make music.
Oh wow!
And it's absolutely, and like people say, you know, it's we're on a pretty old engine here. We're on a fucking fossil of a console at this point, you know, when it came out in 2017, it was already less powerful than the competition. So the Switch feels impossibly old. And I'm not saying Tears of the Kingdom doesn't feel like a kind of last-gen game. It does. It feels, you know, all Switch games do. They just feel old by this point.
Yeah.
But it's eternally impressive, you know, what they managed to pack into this game.
Mm.
The three tiers of like level design all being in seamlessly, because did you do any of the kind of side or all side quests, really? I'm thinking of Final Fantasy terms, sorry. Have you done any of the kind of bits that require you to jump from an island and go in the sky and go all the way down into the depths?
Yeah,
you know, the whole thing can load seamlessly, you know, down into, and it's an amazing piece of tech for the Nintendo Switch, you know, boasted by like just a very good art style, which I'm gonna save today. And but then also you have this central mechanic that doesn't break the game.
Yeah.
I'm sure people have now, you know, 7-8 months later, but purposefully breaking the game with all your different hijinks you can do is very hard to do. It's pretty impossible game design, I would say.
It's an incredibly robust game, and the fact they deliver you this mechanic that, you know, you can get through the game just by scratching the surface.
Yeah.
You don't really have to go into the depths of it. But if you want to, as you said, the stuff you can make is incredible. I think, man, that's really interesting that you think. I didn't feel like Tears of the Kingdom felt like an old game. And I think, I know why you're saying that, because obviously the Switch is kind of, you know, on its last legs here at this stage. But like, Tears of the Kingdom to me is one of the most, like, it's a technical marvel. Like, I know you're also trying, you're making that point as well, but the game did, maybe I'm misremembering this, it launched pretty much in perfect condition.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, yeah. It's true. It's a good point.
There's been no major patching or anything.
That's incredible.
Nope.
Yeah, in the world of games that we now exist in, a game that, as you say, that is packed, overflowing with stuff, it launched without any really major issues or bugs, which is just, it's incredible. It shows what they can squeeze out of the Switch, though, really. It's you know, it kind of feels like, we've gotten, you know, more stuff maybe, guys, the last 7-8 years, it'd be nice. I think, it's incredible.
I know, I felt the need to preface it as a kind of, you know, but the Switch is old and the graphics aren't as good, but I completely agree with you, and I want to kind of emphasize that I do think Tears of the Kingdom is one of those all-timers, like, should be studied in museum pieces of game design for what they pulled out of the Switch, like you said, but also just that they managed, like, yeah, such a good point that it, like, there was no patches or anything. They made this thing. Mm-hmm. And people are kind of like, why did they reuse the same map? Why did this take 6 years to make? And you can, I can't fathom someone playing this game and not seeing how it took 6 years to make. The reason it took 6 years to make is because it's this good. They could have busted out a kind of inferior version of this idea in 3 years, probably, you know?
Get them to go play Starfield. Have them sit down, play Starfield for a few hours, and then come back to you. Because that is a ludicrous thing to say.
Skull and Bones took 10 years to be essentially...
Oh, the first quadruple A game.
To effectively be a worse version of Assassin's Creed Black Flag. So
yeah, €25 off it today, I saw, on sale. So,
I saw
something,
I think... Does Black Flag has like 5 times the player count of Skull and Bones on Steam at the moment?
Fuck me, from 2013. Yeah. Wow.
But it's just it's astounding thing. And but I have a question for both of you. Okay, this game is sold like gangbusters. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons it did is because it's Legend of Zelda and it's a popular Nintendo game. Mm-hmm. Forget that. One of the other reasons I think it did is because it had a big meme ability.
Yes.
It was very present on the interwebs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, here's my question. This is Nintendo. They're old fogies.
Yeah.
They're up in an attic in the rocking chair. Did they do what they always do and just go, oh, we've come up with a great central mechanic. Let's build a game around this and just go for it. Did they purposefully create something that they thought could be shared on the internet, could be posted, could just have big virability? Could you fathom Nintendo doing such a thing on purpose?
No.
You go first, Ken.
No. Absolutely not.
I knew. Yeah, because if they knew that, they're like, oh, how can we make money by doing that? That would have been the exact question they'd have asked themselves.
If they thought that like clips of this would have gone viral or would have been interesting, they would have launched a fucking OnlyFans so they could charge people to watch it.
100%, yeah. Yeah, or, yeah, their own version of Twitch or something. They absolutely would have.
You get premium TikToks because that's what they'd be after. They'd be looking for fucking $2 a pop.
But here's the thing.
It's a good question.
But here's the thing. In Breath of the Wild, okay, there's minecarts.
Yeah.
And there is the Magnesis power, which lets Link pick up magnetic shit. And people basically broke the game. And you can do something with Magnesis while you're standing in a minecart, and you can basically fly around in it.
Yeah.
And all stuff like that was all over the internet when Breath of the Wild came out in 2017. Breath of the Wild was like a similar thing. Because it's a sandbox game, you know, there's all sorts of mischief. I truly believe that Donkey's video of Breath of the Wild sold thousands of units of that game because it was absolutely just an unadulterated look at the fun of the game, you know, just the silliness of it. I just have to think, did Nintendo have this new mechanic with the Ultra Hand and building things in mind, or did they see people breaking their previous game online and go, holy shit, let's build on that? Do you think they were inspired by their player base, at least? If not... They didn't try to want to make a game that can go viral easily. Do you think they were inspired by their player base?
Yeah, I think that I can go along with. I think there have been some comments made by the dev team that they were like impressed by what the players had managed to come up with exploiting the sort of the physics systems in Breath of the Wild. So I do think that was probably on their mind leading into the development of Tears of the Kingdom. Whether it was in terms of like the meme ability of it or how it's spread on social media, I don't think I can give them that much credit. Like the business types, the suits at Nintendo, as far as they're concerned, it's still a playing card company. They don't care where the money's coming from. They just care about the money. It's just, I suppose, because of the news today about them shutting down Yuzu, the Switch emulator, I'm particularly disinclined to cut them any sort of fucking slack.
Yeah, bang on, man. I'm fucking furious about that. But like, the thing to give him a tiny sliver of credit again, like as we've gone through this podcast, I think from the jump from Breath of the Wild to Tears of the Kingdom, most of the issues you had with Breath of the Wild were mostly fixed in Tears of the Kingdom or improved upon. It actually does feel like Nintendo and the devs genuinely did take a look at Breath of the Wild, listen to what people said, and try to improve things and make things better.
In a kind of belligerent way, though, and I respect them for this. If they've truly listened to the fan complaints, they probably would have removed weapon durability. But what they did was double down on it go, we're going to have more weapon durability. In fact, they're going to be more durable than ever. But the thing is, we're going to put all these new mechanics and systems in place that you can build your own shit. You don't want a weapon that breaks easily, you build it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think it was meeting in the middle. I would call that meeting in the middle, but yeah, you're
right. But it's respect. It's self-confidence, like, because that was a massive device development that would still be talked about years later in terms of, you know, the negativities of people, you know, people's opinions and breath. Well, I just think it's massive confidence in their own game design to go, no, that's kind of, because I do think, like, it's like one of the most tedious subject matters now, because it's like, you know, it's been debated to death.
Yeah.
I do think the weapon durability is very important to Breath of the Wild and how that game is balanced. You would have a different game if you were able to just get a sword and decide this is your cool sword and use it, you know?
I think it was a great mechanic, but then, and Steph won't mind me saying this, it's the number one reason she stopped playing Breath of the Wild.
Right. It's
which is interesting to me. It's just, it's found it really annoying and repetitive to keep doing that. But it's been talked to death forever. But as long as, I think they met in the middle, and we'll give them that. But fuck
Nintendo. But it's not even just Ultra Hand in the game. Like I said, what do they call the weapon? Fuse, isn't it? Fuse. You can fuse things to your weapons and your shields to create all these bonkers weapons that just, I know, it ends up kind of snaking out all to these different avenues that are really, like, obviously there's more creativity in how you build your weapons and you can build different weapons for different uses, but I also thought it made enemy drops more exciting.
Definitely.
Because if you kill a cool enemy and they have a cool horn, it's not just a crafting item now. You can stick it directly onto the sword you have and then have like a +60 powerful ass sword for your next boss fight, you know? So the new systems in place kind of, you know, they improve things, you know, sprinkles out through the game as well. But you know what one of the most impressive things about Tears of the Kingdom is? Low-key most impressive thing, in terms of them managing to design this game without breaking it, is what's that one that lets Link fucking jump into any ceiling?
Ascend.
Yeah. Must have been a logistical, but it must have been a logistical nightmare design-wise, let alone in a open world sandbox game. They decided to go, imagine if some supervisor came up to him and was like, all right, I want you to implement this idea where Link can jump into any ceiling and come out the other side of it. Wouldn't that, you know, change the whole design? Yes, make sure players can't break this game or skip it entirely.
Yeah, like, whatever about the open world design, but it's like the dungeon or temple design with that ability in mind.
Yeah.
Like, every single platform, every single roof becomes a potential ascend target. And it allows people to just completely, like, skip entire sections of the design if they could find the right pixel to ascend through. And what I really respect about Nintendo is that instead of trying to rule that out, they just rolled with it. It's just part of the design. Like, if you can find a way, anything you can find to do within the temple is fair game, because they've given you the tools, they've given you the sandbox to play in. Like that fire temple, I skipped most of the mine character backward and forward just by finding spots to ascend through.
Oh. Well, listen. The thing is, what did you guys think of the main quest line of this game? Because the Divine Beasts from the first game are controversial. I think they're quite neato, but of course they're not traditional Zelda dungeons. So a lot of people thought, you know, it was never confirmed, but a lot of people kind of decided themselves, oh my god, from what we can see in these trailers, they're doing traditional Zelda dungeons in this one, which did not end up being the case. But they definitely skirt closer to traditional Zelda dungeons. They are kind of temples. They're more kind of themed than the Divine Beasts were, but they are very much living beside the game's ability for you to use all these tools, the Ascend, the Ultra Hand, to kind of maybe break sequences. Did you end up enjoying them?
I didn't love them. I don't think there was any.
You still don't think they're classic Zelda dungeon tier?
Not really. No, I don't think there was any dungeon in Tears of the Kingdom that I would put ahead of maybe a dozen temples from previous games. I don't know if anything in Tears of the Kingdom cracks like my personal top 10 or maybe 20, I don't know. But they were definitely good, and I definitely feel like they were a step in, not necessarily the right direction, but at least the direction I wanted anyway. They're closer to what I was looking for than the Divine Beasts.
I particularly liked the fire one and the desert one, but I think, Marcel, you hated the desert one, didn't you?
Hate is maybe accurate. I think the temples were, it's weird. I'm on the exact opposite side of you, Kev. I really like the Divine Beasts in Breath of the Wild, but for people listening, I haven't been playing Zelda my whole life. Do you know what I mean? It's not, you know, I anything like that was really fascinating to me. I thought the temples in this were the most disappointing part of the game, if I'm being honest. What's the water temple? Azor's Domain, is that what it's called, I think?
The water temple is
the war temple.
Worst one, definitely.
Yeah, I just thought that was... I was like, okay, I can swim up waterfalls. That's pretty cool. What else is happening here? You know, but again, it doesn't detract, which is an amazing thing to say, by the way. I'm saying the temple is the most disappointing part of the game. They're a huge part of the game. But for me, it doesn't detract from the overall game. But no, I would have been happy with, you know, a few more beasts thrown in there, to be honest.
But there's a lot more to just the temples in the main quest. Like, I really liked it's in the water temple as well, but in the wind temple, you have to scale all these floating blocks to get up to it.
Yeah.
And it's just huge, and you're kind of flying on these flying ships, and you're using kind of your bird companion to blow you around and stuff like that. And I remember just, you know, because you're fighting enemies on these precarious platforms, and you're going really high, you're going higher than you've ever been in the game. And I remember putting... mushroom onto the tip of my sword, and I was literally just yeeting them off the side of the and I kind of realized I wasn't getting any of their pickups, but it was just too fun because I was just one-shotting everyone, just like boing boing them off the side, and it was just very memorable to me, that stuff like that. And then you get to the very top of it, you have to dive down into a tornado, and it leads down into the dungeon. So even like if the dungeon itself is the most memorable thing, like stuff like that really sticks with me.
That moment in particular was huge. Because as you said, the paths to get there is a lot of fun. There's that big dramatic moment where you dive in through the cloud. And then for me, having the word temple pop up on the screen, wind temple, I was like, oh shit, they're doing it. And as it turns out, like, they're kind of not, but it's still good.
Yeah, I did. The only thing I would say as well about the temples is I was kind of disappointed that they kind of ended the exact same way for each of them. Did you find that?
Oh, in terms of the cutscenes?
Yeah, the little cutscene, and it's a new thing. I was like, okay, I'm like, but it's fourth time. I was like, this is
because they want you to do them in any order, you see, so you need to get the same information from each one. There's definitely a more interesting way to do that, though.
Yeah. I mean, there is like the Uncharted side game that I can't remember the name of, Lost Legacy. There's an open area bit in that where you have to solve like three puzzles on the top of three towers. You can do them in any order you want, but the game accounts for it. So it knows the order you do them in and changes the following ones as a result. So every time you climb a tower, regardless of which tower you climb, whichever tower you climb second, you'll see the second puzzle and the second conversation. So, there's games that are
ways to do it.
Accounting for you can do this in any order, but it doesn't have to be repetitive, you know?
But that kind of segues in, I'm a sassy Zelda fan in the terms of maybe loathe to do it, but you know, it's because I just think it's like the sixth or seventh most important thing. But what do you think of the story of Tears of the Kingdom?
Yeah, like I said, it's nothing special, but I don't come to Zelda games for the story, you know.
Yeah. I don't know if we're spoiling it. It at least got me teary eyed in the final moments of it. Which is pretty big deal ending for is a very Zelda strong, game.
In fairness,
the ending is very strong. Yeah, oh,
the music.
Yeah.
I think the story, the overarching thing that kept me engaged was I am a bit of a sucker for a little bit of historical kind of a thing. Mm. You know, these are the people of yesteryear, and oh wow, I'm getting all their cool shit from back then. That's really awesome. So that just about pulled me through it. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If people listening to this, the reason this episode took so long is because it took Jonathan absolutely forever to get to the end of this game. Not because I was busy. I am absolutely not. Very much just because I had to put it down for a while. I was like, I love it. I think it's an amazing game. But I was like, okay. I think it was you, Liam, in a way, not your fault. Oh. I think I asked you. We were talking about it. And I mentioned, I was like, oh, I'm after finishing, you know, whatever what I thought was the last temple. And then I kind of quickly discovered, and Liam was like, oh yeah, and I was like, I'm really done, Liam, haven't I? And you were like, yeah, sure,
actually one thing where it deviates from the structure of Breath of the Wild is that there's a secret fifth area after you do, well, not an area, but a fifth chunk of the game in another dungeon,
right.
You do after,
yeah,
not including the main dungeon, we'll say, yeah.
Yeah, big time. And that just made me kind of put it down for a little
I should
while.
Have told but, you get a fucking mech or something. Yeah. I should have told you get a robot companion. That might have egged you on.
What a mad thing that actually happened. I love that. But no, I think, that part of the story dragged me through it enough. But I'm not sure which one of you just said it there. It wasn't Owen because he's not here. But it still, man, packed an emotional punch for me at the end, though, in a big way, to be honest.
Yeah, I think in Breath of the Wild as well, whenever you actually get to a proper cutscene and characters are talking to each other, I kind of don't like it. I kind of fought against Zelda having voice acting for ages. I was always kind of, because it's kind of forgotten now, but Zelda was always a franchise that, you know, people were saying, why isn't there voice acting? It's like, I remember when Twilight Princess came out, you know, why isn't there voice acting? You know, because it was, it went for years, well after most games were fully voiced. And I always said, like, I don't know, I like it residing in my head, you know? I don't know, I don't want to hear these characters talk. And I think Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom is kind of a justification for that. It's not a bad localization by any account. It's not a great one, to be honest. It's not like, the voice actors are doing their job, but it feels like a kind of an older game.
Yeah.
But whenever you're kind of in the world and kind of doing the story that way, like in a lot of Zelda games, and the emotion of the piece of just getting to Ganondorf, you know, finding Zelda and all that, none of the cutscenes made me emotional for that story. It was all through the gameplay in the world, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it culminates in a great bit of storytelling through gameplay that I was the aforementioned teary-eyedness. I thought that was like really well executed, and for a Zelda game, it was extremely well executed because you don't really expect that, you know. Because I remember one thing about Breath of the Wild, I remember feeling absolutely nothing at the ending. I thought it was just like, yep, just, there we go. I did it. Doesn't change the journey to get there, but and Tears of the Kingdom was the opposite. I thought the last boss was like, and I mean this not in the kind of, you know, gamer kid way, but I thought it was like really epic. It was just this really kind of, yeah, this is what you want at the end of a massive adventure. And I'm just like, this is the scale of it, and it's huge, and the music is
falling down to a dragon. it takes you so long. Like, it took me quite a long period to finish that game. I had to go back because the one thing we don't talk enough about Tears of the Kingdom, one of my favorite mechanics of it is coming up against a boss that's kind of tough, and you have to kind of go off then for 2 hours and gather stuff. You know, you're cooking shit. You know, you're finding new recipes. What was it in this? It was like, was it not sunflower?
Yeah, sunflower flowers.
Sundelions? Sundelions, yeah, yeah.
You need those.
Sundelions, that's it, yeah, to restore your hearts, right? So because you then went off and spent time really getting geared up, it did feel like when you get to the, you know, at the end, you're kind of like, I'm fucking ready, man. I am so stocked up with shit. I've got like, you know, 85 jars of milk. I'm going to destroy you. But it did give this kind of big sense of epicness and hugeness. One second, just back to what you were talking about, kind of voice acting. And maybe this is just me. I thought Zelda, anytime Zelda spoke, I was like, why does it sound so odd?
I'm not going to bandwagon it because she gets a lot of guff on the internet.
Yeah, it's definitely not just you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's I'm with you though, Marcy, but like, I don't
Link.
Know.
Link!
That was really
wrong.
Why was that really good?
It was.
It's like, are you okay? You're just standing there. Everything's fine now. You haven't even, nothing's really happened. Link!
I do think Matt Mercer did a great job as Ganon, though, absolutely chewing on the scenery.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot it was Matt Mercer. Yeah, God, yeah. He's in Final Fantasy as well, actually.
He is. He's Vinnie Val. Yeah.
So do you have any more moments from that game that you remember? Because I know, Marcy, you sent me a message the first time you fought Phantom Ganon.
Yeah, that was cool.
that was because you fought him three times?
You find one of the coolest enemies to stumble upon in that world are these mess of hands, and the whole music changes, and if you defeat those hands, Phantom Ganon comes out of it. So I remember the first time I defeated those hands, and they're really difficult.
Yeah.
They all die, and then an energy bar comes. It's very From Software, Kev.
Yeah.
An energy bar just appears, and it's just like Phantom Ganon. And I was like, wait, what? What? What's happening?
I like it. It does a really cool thing where, you know, obviously there is no difficulty level in the game. It's a game where you can actually approach it and you can make it pretty easy for yourself.
Oh, for sure.
But if you want a really, which I think is great, if you want a really tough challenge, you can kind of go off and find it. Like I talking about speed runs and stuff like that. I saw someone defeat, you know, the entire end of the game there, Ganon, with just three hearts.
Yeah,
which I thought was absolutely. That's the type of skill I could never hit.
But isn't that the essence of the first game, where it's like you can get to Hyrule Castle anytime you want? The whole story is to go around and make Link stronger, get him the Master Sword, get him more hearts, get it, and then the Divine Beast. What do they actually do? You know, gameplay wise, they have the final boss's energy bar.
Yeah.
I sometimes think how rude of us to even criticize either of these games in this podcast at any point. Like, if someone ever talks about video games and not being an art form, just show that, say, play these two games back to back and come back to me. They're just like absolutely incredible.
Are you down? Do you understand? Can you empathize with people not vibing with them though? Because I kind of can, I think.
Yeah, I think some people just need or want more focus from their game.
But I do as well. Like, I've played Minecraft and stuff a couple of times, and I just don't think it's something that I could play because it is goalless. You make your own goals.
Yeah.
I don't think, even though it's apt to describe them as sandbox games, they're not quite that though, are they?
No.
There's always things to do. There's always quests to go after, and you're always doing. I just think it's. The exploration always worked for me in those games, and getting sidetracked and kind of getting lost in, you know, because there is always a kind of a focus. There is somewhere you're ultimately going to do, you know.
Your hand is always somewhat held. I don't think it's very. No, to answer your question, no, I can't vibe with those people because I do think both the games have something for everyone. I think maybe if it's, you know, again, we just keep talking about this, like open world games and, you know, not liking them and et cetera, et cetera. I think it's the kind of game where what you put into it, you get out of it, which sounds really silly and sounds like it's a job or work. which maybe this isn't a good angle.
I think
John.
That's fair enough.
But, you know, I think so. Like, I think, and again, like, you know, Steph, you know, future wife, she's great. When I was like, no, I was like, play Breath of the Wild more. And she's like, no, the weapons degrade and break apart. I'm like, yeah, I get that. But have you done the shrines? Aren't they just great?
Yeah.
So I think it's just you need to really put in the time and really explore as much of it. And it'll hook you eventually. But also, you know, I'm not a big Zelda fan. I never have been. But both these games would probably be in my top 10 now. Do you know what I mean? So it converted me in a big way, and I'm probably being a bit biased.
And do you think it's harder to recommend Breath of the Wild to someone now that Tears of the Kingdom exists?
Oh, that's sad, isn't it? Yeah.
See, I don't know. I think there definitely is a benefit to playing Breath of the Wild first.
But you don't need to.
You absolutely don't need to. But I think
a
lot of what Tears of the Kingdom did was such an evolution on Breath of the Wild that you don't really appreciate that unless you've played Breath of the Wild first. It kind of makes it sound like you need to finish your lunch, your dinner before you can have your dessert. Like, but.
Yeah. Do you know what I'm really glad they held back on in Tears of the Kingdom, and they actually didn't include them at all in the second game, but they're such a huge factor in Breath of the Wild, is the Guardians.
Yeah.
Because now the Guardians feel like such a kind of they're intrinsic to Breath of the Wild. They're one of the most iconic enemies in that game in Zelda ever. And, you know, the piano cue of, you know, the lasers.
I can hear it in my head.
Going through big open fields and being tracked by a laser and just the piano kicking in wasn't recreated for Tears of Kingdom, so now it feels just for that first game, you know.
Yeah, I don't necessarily love the music in Breath of the Wild as much as I do a lot of other Zelda games, but that in particular is the thing that I do love about it, is the any of the music surrounding the guardians or the shrines and stuff, that sort of that weird sort of plonky percussive piano sound. It sounds like R2-D2 doing the Scatman, you know. It's just
I just talk about the music for a second, because I agree with you. I don't, because old Zeldas are like chock full of earworms, like every single one of them. I don't think Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom is that, but I think they're amazing.
With a couple of big examples or exceptions.
Huge
exceptions.
I will say, to hark back to old Zelda, Marcy, you never played the Wind Waker, Marcy, no?
No, I never.
That's
did.
Exactly so the example I was going to bring up as well.
There's a musical track in the Wind Waker called Dragon Roost Island. You get to this island, and it's just like very cool, like very earwormy island jam. Never in Zelda again. And then in Breath of the Wild, the melody is reused for Rito Village. And I swear to God, I nearly broke into tears when I walked into that village for the first time. Like, my childhood just like almost came out through my ear ducts. It was such an emotional moment. Because the Zelda music is so important to me. And again, in Tears of the Kingdom, they fucking weaponized that piece of music again. Because this time they put it into a boss theme.
Yeah.
It plays in the, called Cold Aga, that Caldera, that big flying ice boss.
Yeah.
For just 10 seconds of that track, the Dragon Roost Island theme kicks in the middle of it. It's like...
Stop. We're going to get done for copyright strike.
Oh my God. And again, I was like, you bastards. So there are... There aren't a lot of that in those games. The music is very ambient, but it's incredibly ambient, like very minimalist kind of musical cues can just feel cold. Do you know what I mean? So, coldness can be just exuded through the music. And I love how when you're like riding your horse, you just hear the kind of trickles of the main theme, almost like it's whipping past you with the wind. It's like, you know, and it's I think they're amazing soundtracks, but like, I don't think I'd listen to them on a soundtrack, but playing the game, I think they're incredibly important to kind of the atmosphere of that world. But it is very minimalist. Yeah. I understand why a lot of people don't really like it.
It does have one of my favorite tracks though of any game ever. I've been trying to think of its name sitting here. I think it's called The Last Catch or The Last Fall. Mm-hmm. One of the others. It's when you're literally diving to catch Zelda.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
there's a piece of music that plays there, and like, because I was thinking, we were talking about getting teared up by that scene. I was at the time, I'm like, am I sad because of this bare bones story I've been encountering for 100 hours, or is it this amazing piece of music? And I've been listening to that an awful lot on Spotify lately.
Good news for you, Warsi. From what I recall, that does a little bit of a Zelda medley. I think it does the Tears of the Kingdom theme, it does Zelda's Lullaby from Ocarina of Time, and it does the main Zelda theme. The main as you're diving, so you can pick apart that track you like and find it all through Zelda history.
Where do you think where do they go next with Zelda?
That's like, a huge question, isn't it?
I think Tears of the Kingdom really is just one of the greatest examples of video games. What do you do next?
My attitude earlier on was like, I know what Nintendo are like, I know they'll stick to a formula, but doesn't it feel so thoroughly rinsed out and it's explored.
Yeah, it's done. Yeah.
As a Zelda fan, maybe just as a fan of games, I don't know. Yeah. I would like the Switch era to be just that, I think.
Yeah.
They've done this twice now, and people were very kind of like, they're doing it again for Tears of Kingdom. That's this point, but and then they nailed it. I think, I don't know if they will, but I would be okay with them going smaller.
Yep.
Yeah.
I would be okay with it. Will they ever do a traditional Zelda again? And that's, I don't know. If you design a game like Tears of the Kingdom, do you go back to old design philosophies again? You know, I don't know.
Yeah. My prediction, and it's not so much a prediction as kind of a hope / stab in the dark, is with the Switch 2 or whatever that hardware ends up being called. Mm-hmm. I don't think Nintendo are going to do just a Switch 2. It's not just going to be a more powerful version of the Switch. They're going to innovate in some way with the hardware. Mm-hmm. And whatever that hardware innovation is, that's what's going to shape the central conceit of the next Zelda game.
Yeah.
So,
and just to be different, Kevin, so we can have the recording here, I think the opposite. I think this is going to be... I think the Switch 2 is just going to be a more powerful Switch, because I think they've learned their lesson. After the Wii sold incredibly well, they did the Wii U, tried to innovate again, tried something different, blew up on their face. I think now they're like, okay, look, people went mad for the Switch. Let's just do something very, very similar with, you know, far more powerful. Well, we already know we're getting an LCD screen again, right? Isn't that, I think, already confirmed? Yeah. So again, it's annoying. I think they're going to go, okay, Tears of Kingdom again, as you said, Liam, sold gangbusters. I think let's just do that again. I think they're going to do something similar in the framework of it being an open world Zelda, and maybe lean into it a bit harder.
Set on a new map this time with a new central mechanic.
Yeah,
new map, new central mechanic, and new vibe don't have it look or feel like the other two. And what you have there is your basic Zelda sequel. Like, Wind Waker, despite being set in the open ocean, is structured exactly the same as Ocarina of Time. You know, that's what they do. You know, but like, would you be happy with that, Kev, if they did that?
I mean, realistically, after Breath of the Wild, I was like, I don't see any way that they can go bigger in scope from here and it not be shite.
Yeah.
I think they have to go back to a smaller game. They have to go back to traditional dungeons. And then I was proved to be, you know, entirely wrong, as I am on a daily basis. So I don't know. I would like to see a smaller game next time around, but if they do go bigger scope, but just with a different map, I'm going to end up loving it anyway.
I want your future though, Kev. I want, because like, who else is going to do that kind of innovation right now anyway? Do you know what I mean? So
Nintendo,
I want your future.
Nintendo are always good for giving us what we don't know we want, you know?
Yeah. What I've heard bandied about, and it's like entirely not even industry rumor, it's just rumor, but I like the sound of it, so I'm going to manifest it by spreading it again, is a Switch 2 that kind of harks back a little bit to the Wii U. in that, instead of just docking it and having it on the console, that maybe there's a dongle or something that you can wirelessly transmit from the unit to the TV and then use a dual screen. So you'd have a screen in your hand and a screen on the television.
And they love two
screens. They love dual screens. Mm-hmm. Nintendo fucking love dual screens. And something like that in a modern Zelda would be really interesting, because it's something that I thought they were going to do for Breath of the Wild when it was originally announced as a Wii U exclusive.
Wii U game, exactly.
I thought the Sheikah Slate was going to be this physical thing in your hand on the Wii U gamepad.
Probably was at one point before they had to change it for the Switch, you see.
It's a great show.
So maybe if they had that idea in place for an early draft of Breath of the Wild, maybe we could see something similar on new hardware down the line. Again, this is almost entirely baseless speculation. I just think it sounds cool.
You heard it here first. Can I ask one final question?
Please.
Where do you rank them in your, let's say, top three Zelda games of all time?
It's weird because I do think, and you have to take into consideration, I think Tears of the Kingdom knocks Breath of the Wild down to ranking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just, it just has to be the way it has to. So, these are my favorites. You know, my favorite's always going to be Majora's Mask. It's my favorite game of all time.
Yeah.
I'm probably putting Tears second, I think.
And Breath of the Wild doesn't make the top three.
Not anymore, no. Then Ocarina of Time, I'd say. Then you go down with your Link's Awakening, Link Between Worlds, Wind Waker, et cetera, no particular order, but yeah.
Yeah.
I think you have to put Breath of the Wild down now. I think you have to.
Mm.
No? Breath of the Wild, it depends how you look at it. Is it the importance of when it came out, or is how it stacks up now with the library of games we have?
To you, very much to you. So your answer is...
I'm putting Breath of the Wild down, yeah.
Yeah, then I would say Tears of the Kingdom, Breath of the Wild, or Karina. But again, as I said, didn't play much when I was younger. But what about you, Pete?
I think I'd probably go like the same top three as Liam, but I'd probably put Ocarina first, then Tears, then Majora's Mask. But it's, you know, it's like, what's your favorite Fabergé egg? They're all amazing, you know.
What is your favorite Fabergé egg, Kev?
The one that's... fuck, I got it. It's on.
That's everyone's
favorite. Butt plug. It's a butt plug. Yeah. Sorry.
And as all conversations inevitably get to butt plugs, let's leave it there.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Hey Look Listen, and Zelda One, which I enjoy. Please continue listening, continue to support us. If you could give us just a like and a follow on our socials, that would be fantastic. Marcy, where are we on our social networks? Where do we exist these days?
All the popular ones. You got your Instagrams, your Facebooks,
LinkedIn,
X, LinkedIn. Yeah. That's blown up. We've got 8 followers. That's huge. Huge traction there. And also keep an eye out for us on TikTok. Some more little videos there soon. Yeah.
Exciting.
And on that note, my name was Liam Sheehan. I was joined here by Jonathan Morrissey and Kevin O'Carroll. Please join us next time. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, Jesus.